My name is Elliot Terry. You're listening to, right now, the start of the Bread and Roses show. And
Bread and Roses.
There we go. That's our theme song.
Oh, hear the people singing, Bread and Roses.
All right, hear the people singing.
As we come marching, so many women dead. We cry through our city, their ancient call for bread. Our stomachs are empty, but our hearts are hungry too. Oh, hear the people singing, Bread and Roses. Oh, hear the people singing, Bread and Roses.
I am most grateful for the invitation to address this joint session of Congress in the land of the free and the home of the brave. I would like to think that the reason for this is that I too am a son of this great continent from which we have all received so much and toward which we share a common responsibility.
Oh, hear the people singing, Bread and Roses. Oh, hear the people singing.
All right.
Bread and Roses.
Good afternoon.
As we come
and welcome to the Bread and Roses show. The voice you just heard is that of Pope Francis, addressing a joint session of Congress on Thursday. Let me just say right here, this is WXOJ LP 103.3, and we are online at valleyfreeradio.org. And the emphasis here is on free at Valley Free Radio. We are free of corporate control and are all volunteer and are a Pacifica affiliate. Check us out at valleyfreeradio.org. My name is Elliot Terry. I am your host for today's show. And the first days of autumn arrived, so has a historic visitor to the USA. Pope Francis arrived in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday and met with President Obama on Wednesday. After passing throngs of adoring, cheering admirers, he said mass there and the next morning addressed a joint session of Congress. Although he touched upon the issues of the human causes to climate crisis or climate change, what he's calling it climate crisis, he didn't spend too much time on that. His address was more of a dialectical charm offensive with moral overtones. That is to say, he reveled in his self-appointed role as a unifier, breaking down barriers and calling out tendencies toward polarity, in particular the reductionism of good and evil. At the same time, Francis said that he wanted to have a dialogue with American working people who, in their own quiet, these are his words, in their own quiet way, sustained the life of society. He used the examples of four American historic figures: Abraham Lincoln, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Dorothy Day, the founder of the Catholic Worker, and theologian Thomas Merton, to frame his moral messages on immigration and the plight of refugees and those seeking a better life in the North. He spoke of liberty, the sanctity of all life at all stages of life, calling, therefore, for the global abolishment of the death penalty. Also urged lawmakers to follow the golden rule and create opportunity with the redistribution of wealth. The Pope also called for an end to the profit-driven arms trade. Today, Pope Francis addressed the 70th anniversary of the United Nations General Assembly, where I believe he spoke on his climate change agenda with the world leaders who will be heading to December's climate agreements at the conference in Paris. And all of the Pope's travels comes on the heels of the release and publication in June of his first encyclical on caring for our common home, Mother Earth. The encyclical's release was followed up with conferences held at the Vatican and attended by religious and political leaders from around the world, as well as scientists. And on today's Bread and Roses show, we'll be discussing the Pope's encyclical titled Laudato Si with two guests. One in the studio, Rabbi David Seidenberg of Northampton, and one by phone, Professor Craig Nicholson from UMass, and one at a time, actually. In the studio with me is Rabbi David Seidenberg. Rabbi Seidenberg is the author of Kabbalah and Ecology, God's Image in the More Than Human World, and is the creator, director of Playground Minyan and neohasid.org. He teaches about spirituality and the Jewish texts, ecology, Hasidic song, embodiment, and dance throughout North America and the world. Rabbi Seidenberg, welcome to the Bread and Roses show.
Thank you.
And now you can make a correction to what I just said.
Oh, so the website is neohasid.org.
Uh-huh.
Neo as in new type of Hasidus,
right.
Hasidut, Hasidic theory and practice and theology. And the name of the meaning is Playground. That is playground with an R, Playground.
What did I say?
I think you said playground, but that's okay. The main point is that we like to make prayer playful, full of dance and song.
I've got Playground written down. I said playground?
Yeah.
Okay. Playground, Minyan. I heard you speak. I want to talk about your work and what these different things are. Rabbi, I heard you speak at the First Churches last week as part of an interfaith panel on Laudato Si that itself was part of a series of interfaith events on faith-based environmental activism, which you are a part of. Could you talk first about the events you are leading, one in early October called the Harvest of Hope, and talk a bit about the genesis of this interfaith effort on behalf of the Pope's encyclical, and more generally about environmental activism. Plus, you can talk a little bit about what the Minyan is.
Sure. Well, the first thing is there's a list of events at harvestinghope.net. And the next big one is October 4th. That's actually the main event happening at Congregation B'nai Israel in Northampton. And that series of events was focalized by Neely Simhai and Rabbi Jacob Fine at Congregation B'nai Israel, along with participation of other synagogues, many churches, activist groups.
Is that in Northampton?
That B'nai synagogue? Israel is in Northampton, yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's off of Prospect.
I know not much, so I'm going to be asking you a lot of questions.
That's fine. But the instigating spirit for this series of events is that we just passed through a sabbatical year in the Jewish calendar. That's a year where traditionally, at least according to the Torah, you don't farm the land, you take down your fences so that the wild animals can go through it and so that anyone can take food from anyone's field. And at the end of the year, you cancel all debts. And then right at the end of it, after you passed through the whole year, lived in this intimate way with the land, canceled all the debts, then you have a celebration at the very end during the Festival of Sukkot, which is what we're about to start on Sunday, the festival where we celebrate the harvest and pray for rain.
And then there's a structure built. Is that true?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sukkah is the name for the structure.
Sukkah is the name, and the Sukkot is the, yeah. I've been to several.
yeah. So there's this celebration that happens once every 7 years, after the sabbatical year, during the holiday of Sukkot, what people sometimes translate as the Festival of Booths. And that's called Hakel. It means assemble. You assemble people to celebrate and to reflect, really. So Neely and Jacob, who are close colleagues of mine in the Jewish environmental movement, had this idea that let's make this a really universal thing, bringing together people from all the different religious groups that we could find. And it's been a marvelous experience. People were spent the whole summer studying about the sabbatical year and what kind of vision of society and ideal it proposes for how we should be living. And then we're coming together now on October 4th to have this big festival to enjoy, really, the fruits of studying and learning and just the enjoyment of the harvest and the season. So that there's a whole series of events that people can find at harvestinghope.net. I think there's some 20 events there that are part of this. And some of these are also involved with the Interfaith Eco Action Group. That is, there's a lot of overlap between the two groups. The latter group was the main focalizer for the Monday night event on the Pope's encyclical that I was part of and that Craig was part of, who's going to be on the show later.
Yeah.
I'm ask the next question or ask where you want.
Oh,
to
I thought you had more on this.
There was in plenty more.
Terms of the interfaith effort, and you talked about just now its genesis, at least in the minds of you and your colleagues, but then getting together with the Climate Action Now, and it's interesting when they say interfaith. Yeah. A lot of folks that listen to this show know I'm a pagan, but the interfaith refers to the Abrahamic faiths.
It often, and it's an interesting thing also just from a Jewish perspective, because Judaism is not a faith.
Oh.
We're a religion. We're about practice. What you believe in Judaism is relevant, but not especially central.
What's going on in Judaism? You are the third dancing, drumming rabbi I've encountered this year. You guys are really getting down. What is going? Is there a charismatic movement ever since the renewal movement started way back?
Yeah, you could say that. I mean, my website is Neo-Hasid. It's about this kind of reflowering of a different kind of Hasidic passion. People may or may not have an association with what Hasidism means, but in its roots, it means a very passionate engagement with Judaism and a kind of mystical engagement with what this is all about. And that's merged with the whole focus on the earth and earth-centered religions. And it's also merged with getting in touch with the tribal roots of Judaism.
Well, I hear that coming through when you spoke, and I hear it very loud and clear. I'm part of a group that goes to pagan ceremonies up in Montague. And the high priestess is also a Jewish priestess.
Tiana.
Yes. Right. And, the connection between the earth and the rituals, the Jewish rituals, is very strong. And the pagan, which, I'm going to get into this later with Professor Nicholson, but a bit. The Catholic religion is considered pagan by the Protestants and by Islam, and in fact it has still the remnants of the pagan past. So that's a tangent. Let me ask the next question and see where we go.
It's a worthy tangent, though, Elliot.
Yeah. Before we get to the Pope's encyclical, I'd like to explore the perspective you may bring to that and the ecology in general by having you talk about your book, The Kabbalah and Ecology, God's Image in the More Than Human World. Kabbalah, of course, is the Jewish mystical tradition, which one would think might be anthropocentric. How does it relate to the more than human ecology?
Yeah, that's exactly the question. All the religions rooted in the Torah are fairly intensely anthropocentric, that is, centered on human beings as the highest value or the greatest good, or, human beings as sort of either in the role of or having the power of a kind of ruler within creation. And that is rooted strongly in the first chapter of the Torah, even though there are many different ways of interpreting it. And the most common Jewish way is to understand it in terms of stewardship, which is a gentle kind of rulership. And it's actually the rulership of someone that does not rule as a king, but as a servant. That's what a steward is.
And that's the theme the Pope is striking in his encyclical.
Right. But even though that's an empowering meaningful perspective in terms of the earth, to think of our role as stewards, from my perspective, it's not enough. We're not going to get where we need to go by simply having a nicer version of anthropocentrism. right? It's not just that it's problematic ethically. It is. As soon as we think that we own or possess or have right, we abuse those rights. That is human nature. it's also that we can't understand God properly, or whatever we mean by God, we can't understand it properly if we think God is our image and not the image of all of creation. No, say that in reverse. If we think we are the image of God, right, which is what it says in the Torah, and we don't see the image of God in the rest of creation, then we are going to devalue the rest of creation, and we are not going to understand what it means, what the word God means, because God is infinite, which means infinitely diverse. And the greatest experience we have of the diversity of anything is the diversity of life around us. This is our experience of what that divine quality is.
You know, I used to sit up for hours with a friend of mine who has embraced Judaism, and we would be like two ancient readers of the Torah. We would debate these mystical issues endlessly, and I was just almost going to bite, but go ahead.
You should bite.
We only have 10 more minutes.
Yeah. That's Judaism's all about that kind of, you know.
Right.
Back and forth. So, and also, we're not understanding what the world is in a scientific sense either, if we think that we're somehow at the pinnacle. Right. So this is where, I love what the Pope has done. He's really given us a great gift. He's really opened up the landscape and the possibilities that may not have been there before, just because he's the one saying it. And he still is very much needing throughout his encyclical to talk about the inherent, infinite, transcendent dignity of human beings. And that's powerful. It's the root of human rights. It's the root of all kinds of very good values that we share. But if we don't extend that idea of dignity in some fashion to all the creatures, to life itself, and not just to human life, then we are going to fail in what our mission is essentially right now, which is to find a right way to live in relationship to the earth. So my book is about finding the resources throughout Jewish history, and especially in Kabbalah, but also in Midrash, also in Hasidism, also in Jewish philosophy, especially Maimonides, for saying that actually there's a transcendent dignity in all life, not just in human life, and to see what that means, to see the image of God in all species, not just in the human species.
Well, to continue on this anthropocentric idea, in the encyclical Laudato Si, the Pope takes a dim view himself of modern anthropocentrism, even as he's talking about maintaining the dignity or of the human. But he's calling the modern anthropocentrism excessive and echoing a favorite of mine, Rupert Sheldrake. He says, modern anthropocentrism has ended up prizing technical thought over reality, since the technological mind sees nature as an insensate order, as a cold body of facts, as a mere given, as an object of utility, he says. It views the cosmos similarly as a mere space into which objects can be thrown with complete indifference. The time has come, he says, to pay renewed attention to reality and the limits it imposes. But that's it, at the end of that quote. But he also criticizes biocentrism, saying it's misguided, that a misguided anthropocentrism need not necessarily yield to biocentrism, for that would entail adding yet another imbalance. Can you wade into this paradoxical debate here?
I can try. First of all, just to go back to the beginning part of that, the idea that technology, the technological mind sees nature as an insensate order, not a living thing, that is not essentially part of science. It's just a part of the science we happen to be most familiar with, and it's the part of the science that is most useful to capitalism in particular. And It goes along with seeing, not just seeing nature as a resource to be used for profit, but also seeing human beings as a resource to be used for profit, right? And so you can't really address one without addressing the other. The Pope does address both of those in powerful ways, and it's really important. But the fear of biocentrism, which you hear not just in the Pope's words here, but many people, Christian, Jewish, I'm not as familiar with Muslim eco-theologians, but I think also in Islam, have this fear that if we go towards biocentrism, we're going to lose grasp of what's important. And we should define biocentrism as really, it's really taking, I believe, Aldo Leopold's land ethic to heart, which is to say that we should not regard human beings, we should not regard ourselves as rulers or preeminent participants in the world, in the land, in nature, but rather as plain citizens who are equal members of a community which includes other citizens, other species. So that's a leveling out of the hierarchy between humans and more than humans, non-humans, right? And that is a more scientific way of looking at it, right? That is how you would look at things if you're thinking about nature in terms of evolution, in terms of biology. It doesn't make sense to think of human beings as being of a different kind of essence than the rest of the world. So if we want to be honest to what the best science can teach us, it also needs to teach us about our organic unity with the rest of creation, with the rest of course, creation is a religious term, but with the rest of the natural order, with the rest of the world that we're among. And the fear is that means that we won't, that if there's nothing special about human beings, we will cease to, I think, live up to any moral standard, live up to any higher value. And I don't think that's true, but it is certainly a risk. It's a problem.
Well, especially since behaviorism came along and, oh God, what's his name? The fellow that created behaviorism. Yeah.
It's escaping me at the moment.
You know, with rats in a maze and beyond freedom and dignity and all of that. I mean, we see the results of behavioral structures within our authoritarian system in this country and in others. So there is that kind of danger if we're just seen as animals that can be programmed.
Yeah. The funny thing, of course, is that, of course, animals also have a certain freedom. And all of nature has a certain freedom. And that's actually what it means to see nature from a mystical perspective, is to see that nature is self-ruling in a certain way, willing its own freedom in a certain way. And what's true also scientifically is that we can see that many species have many aspects of what we think of as uniquely human, including the emotions, including certain kinds of freedom. What's true about humans is that we combine a certain constellation of these qualities in their most extreme degree in one creature, us, right? And that gives us a certain greater degree of freedom. And if you want to go with the way the Pope talks about it and many other theologians, a certain kind of dignity which is special. But what is the essence of that dignity? From my perspective, it's that we have a greater power to serve the rest of creation. That is, most other species, the way they serve the rest of creation is just by being what they are and filling their ecological niche, right? But human beings have the capacity to understand the whole and make sense of it. We have the capacity to fit into every single ecosystem that exists on the land in this planet, and even many that are not on the land, in the sea, etc. So, and we have the capacity to understand those and interact with them in a way where our job is to nurture and increase the possibility of life. And many of the Native American traditions in this country did do that for millennia, in the way they interacted with the salmon or with the forest, etc., the kind of fires that they used to start in order to maintain a certain balance. So that is also grabbing human power and making use of it, but making use of it for something more than ourselves. That is, our power has to be for something besides us. And that's the dignity that humans have, is that we can make our power be something besides that serves a purpose besides our own needs. That's our dignity. We only reach that dignity if we don't think of ourselves as the rulers and the possessors with the right to take what we want.
I want to get back to the connection between science and the changing image of God. There is a book that was co-authored with Matthew Fox and Rupert Sheldrake. And he states that the Enlightenment took the soul or anima out of the earth, and that the cosmos and the earth and the cosmos, and in its place, imposed a mechanistic model upon science and all of creation. And you know, the behavioral B.F. Skinner is his name.
Yeah, there you go.
Behavioral model and the evolution itself is part of that. He points to the Protestant Reformation as helping to do the same for God. The Kabbalah paradoxically had a profound influence upon the medieval European thought and science. Can you explore the paradox and the changing image of God in nature with the science in mind?
That might be too big a question to tackle.
Okay.
I can tell you this. There's a lot of cross currents. And some of the foundations of science were very organismic. Very much seeing the cosmos as a living, single living being. That was the fundamental principle of Maimonides' philosophy, and he was foundational to all of Western science and to the idea of the experimental method. And Kabbalah also has an intricate idea of natural order and how everything works together that is, it can fit nicely into a scientific model of the universe. This idea that somehow we lost the organicity of the universe, that is, I agree, the problem. We had three different kinds of science at a certain point. We had the deists, and the mechanists, and the people who had a more organic idea. So the more organic idea of science would be Leibniz. Goethe was actually doing interesting work in science as well, although he's not known for that as much. And the mechanist would be Descartes, the deist, also mechanistic, Newton. So essentially, if we want to label it, we could say the bad guys won. Mm. And the reason why they won is because their ideas were more useful for gaining power, which people were most interested in.
And at the panel discussion, you had said something that really struck me, that the religions needed to take their mysticism from the margins and move it to the center and take the catechisms and the book essentially and move it to the margins. And how does that shift the image of God?
Well, it's important to see God as mystery and not as a known quantity. The word God can't point to anything that is significantly related to what we mean by God. It's so inadequate. And so in Kabbalah, the word God is actually a very low-level term for describing what we mean when we talk about God. And it's what you use. It's the word you use when you're not talking about the real thing. When you're talking about the real thing, you talk about the Ein Sof, the infinite. You don't use the word God anymore. What's that? So the image of God or the meaning of God, the concept of God, we need to start off understanding that it is a very small box for something that's much bigger than that. What's that?
We've got about 30 seconds.
Oh, okay. Well, Craig's about to call in, is he not?
Yeah.
Do you want me to hang out for, a little bit when
oh,
he
you
comes
can.
On? I can stay for a few minutes. It would be sure lovely to interact with him a little bit if it works.
Yeah, let me just play a little bit of audio here.
I humbly give all respect to His Holiness Pope Francis, who has awakened people across the globe to the dangers we face as a planet. He has brought us together today in that spirit of action, and I think it is fair to say he's the most powerful voice on this earth for those all over the world whose voices are not being heard. His Holiness challenges us not to be captives, not to be slavish to consumerism, as citizens to rise above it. He also challenges us not to be captive as leaders to powerful corporate interests. The encyclical is not a call to arms, it is a call to sanity. It's a reminder that we as leaders have a sworn duty to protect. But how can we protect our people if we accept a status quo that is slowly killing our earth? We're called here to take Laudato Si and give it life, to systematically address the danger of climate change with every tool we have. And it's increasingly clear that we, the local leaders of the world, more than we may have in fact realized, and that we must use them boldly, even as our national governments hesitate. All that we are doing in New York, I'd like to announce our next big step. We are committing to 40 by 30 on our way to 80 by 50, a reduction of our emissions levels by 40% by the year 2030.
What you were just listening to was the mayor of New York, Mayor de Blasio, talking after he had attended the conference at the Vatican, talking about the impact of Laudato Si from his perspective, and the charge of that was given to all those politicians to further the message of of the encyclical. I guess you didn't get to hear that, Craig, but let me introduce you before we go any further.
Certainly.
All right. So calling in from the University of Massachusetts is Professor Craig Nicholson, who is the director of the Sustainability Science Master's Program at UMass, addressing questions of how people interact with natural resources and how ecosystems change over time, as well as Arctic system science for 15 years. Professor Nicholson is a Catholic and has been following Pope Francis's work closely, and will be leading a semester-long seminar on his encyclical next semester. Professor Nicholson, welcome to the Bread and Roses Show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here with you.
Actually, Rabbi Seidenberg is still with us.
Oh, wonderful.
And we've been talking about the intersection of science and God and faith and ecology and activism. So, Professor Nicholson, first I'd like you to explain what your work is in sustainability and maybe even offer a definition and how that dovetails with the planned seminar on Laudato Si.
People have been arguing about the definition of sustainability for a long time, but let me tell you a bit about my background and how I come to be doing what I'm doing here at UMass. My original training is actually in civil engineering, and my graduate work was in environmental engineering and in modeling rivers and how rivers change through time, sort of ecosystem modeling type work. And I came to the U.S. In 1996 because I wanted to work on things that would bring together the social and the natural sciences, and got involved in this project working on the sustainability of Arctic communities. So that was back in the late 1990s, and we were working with indigenous communities up in Alaska and northwest Canada. And one of the at one point when we were talking with a group of elders, one of the elders said, "Sustainability, big word, little meaning." And that's always stuck with me because it's one of those things that I think it's hard for people to sort of nail it down and give it a clear, concise definition.
Well, it also depends on what your agenda is, because I hear a lot of people that are you know, economists or on the business report, and they'll be talking about sustainability in terms of a goal, using their whatever means possible to sustain the current lifestyle and output and increase it. So it's not exactly what I think your definition is.
No, nor the way that the encyclical would be using, it's got a very clear critique of the consumer culture and the throwaway culture that's I think at the root of what you just talked about in the way some people in the business community use that word sustainability.
Yeah. Now, Craig, you were part of that interfaith panel held at, you didn't actually answer the question of how your work dovetails with the planned seminar on Laudato Si.
So it dovetails in two ways, I guess. The one is that universities are places that have specialized for a long time in very specialist knowledge. And so the goal in academia is often just to dive really deep and understand a particular small area in a great deal of detail. But sometimes that's at the expense of seeing the whole forest and being able to see the big picture and see how what one does fits into context. And I guess my interest in the encyclical flow out of my academic interests in being able to reconnect things and have people with different expertise put their perspectives together and try to develop a more holistic way of viewing things. And all the encyclical is really doing is taking that one step further, and the sort of topics which would be covered in a university, in a standard U.S. 21st century large state institution like UMass Amherst, the encyclical is taking that one step further and putting that in the perspective of the dignity of the human person and in the framework of our relationship to God, and saying that that all of these things are connected more deeply than many people realize. So my interest in the encyclical flows out of my interest in trying to see things more holistically rather than in very narrow, disconnected ways. And it also flows out of my desire to live that way as in a more integrated way, so that my Catholic faith on the one hand and my intellectual reason and my day job are not in two watertight separate compartments, but are more integrated.
And Craig, you were part of the interfaith panel held at First Churches on the encyclical, along with Rabbi Seidenberg. I'd like to know how you as a scientist see your faith informing or driving your own care for Mother Earth, and what we should take from this interfaith effort. And I would ask this and other questions referring to a book, as I've mentioned earlier on the show, on this very subject titled Natural Grace, which was co-authored by Matthew Fox and Rupert Sheldrake. You may be familiar with this book, published in 1996. Rupert Sheldrake, who is controversial in the scientific community. Sheldrake, however, quotes philosopher of science Sir Karl Popper, saying that, quote, through modern physics, science has transcended itself, end quote, and also referencing Fritz Capra and his book, The Tao of Physics and Quantum Theory in General, all of which points to a cosmos that is alive as in the Gaia principle. So can you answer the question of how your faith informs you as a scientist and activist for Mother Earth and relation to the other things I posed?
So when I look at many people who are doing strong activist work, the type of activism that I see myself involved in is somewhat different than that, because I've chosen to work within the realm of higher education, and so my activism is an activism of teaching, inquiring with young people, helping shape the way they think about things, and they're the ones who are doing more of the work as once they, both here at the university and then once they leave the university. So that's the first piece I just wanted to mention. But how does my work as a scientist and my faith as a Christian, as a Roman Catholic Christian, how do those things fit together? I've never really seen a disjunction between them, because there's this long-held idea that there's the book of nature and the book of scripture, and so we learn about ourselves, about God, from both sources. There are things we can tell from both looking into the world and from reading Torah, the Christian scriptures. So I've never really seen these as being in two mutually exclusive categories. They do have different ways of going about things, and obviously science is much more focused on quantifying things, and it's sort of concerned with just the material world.
Yes, well, have you noticed over the last several decades or in your career a a shift in science itself to seeing things less inanimate? Let me ask in relation to the next question I was going to ask pose, because I want to get into this question of science versus nature a little deeper. Even though you're saying you've never you've never sensed, and the rabbi also puts the two together, he doesn't see a separation necessarily. In that book that I mentioned, Rupert Sheldrake indicts the mechanistic model of the cosmos, which began with the Enlightenment. And you were mechanical. What was your specialty originally?
In civil engineering.
Civil engineering. So this mechanistic model, and it's applied. It was applied to the natural world. The Pope, in his encyclical, echoes this indictment of the Enlightenment paradigm, while at the same time praising science and technology as a boon for humankind, but harshly criticizing what he terms the technocratic paradigm, and later the techno-economic paradigm at the root cause of our climate crisis. He says, I'm going to quote, humanity has taken up technology and its development according to an undifferentiated and one-dimensional paradigm. This has made it easy to accept the idea of infinite or unlimited growth, which proves so attractive to economists, financiers, and experts in technology. Can you speak to this and your own inner dialogue and conflicts as a scientist?
So science has certainly grown up at a certain time in history, and it does have certain ideas and presuppositions built into it. And it certainly is a part of modern scientific training to get people to think about things only in mechanistic terms and to see things, to try and describe things in terms of the machine. That's the sort of dominant metaphor. I just don't think that's a helpful metaphor for really understanding ecology, ecosystems, living creatures. There's so many key differences between living beings and machines. So I think that science is, this is a sweeping generalization, but science generally does tend to favor that kind of mechanistic view of things. And that's one of the places in which it's hard to go along with everything that goes with a scientific mindset. And I'm curious to hear your perspective, Rabbi David, on that, the science and faith top idea.
I think that we think very similarly about this, but also it seems to me that in many areas of science the cutting edge is about going beyond mechanistic models, and that is really where the growth in science is happening, both in biology and physics and evolutionary theory and all of these kinds of things, in psychology, in the way that psychology and principles that have been only applied to humans are seen as actually applying to other animals, such as tool making, etc. So I think these things are breaking down.
Yeah, that seems right to me as well. I think that it's sort of reached the end of maybe not everyone would agree that it's reached the end of its useful life. Thinking in those terms with this machine metaphor and the very mechanistic model based view of the world, but what you just said about all the cutting edge areas of science, I think is certainly true.
Well, in the book, Sheldrake says that it was the physical sciences, physics in particular, that broke through into a more holistic vision, but that the medical sciences and the natural sciences and biology are still bogged down. I had some kidney stones. You know, and I went to a kidney specialist a few years ago, and I was complaining, and you know, they did some ultrasound tests, and I was complaining about why I was getting these kidney stones, and you know, and it was mostly in one kidney, and he just kind of chuckled, and all around me were the people on dialysis, and he says, well, you know, you got two of them, don't worry, and I kind of felt like, oh my God, is he going to farm me or put my interchangeable part in one of his? Is he looking at me as just a you know, part of his scrapyard or something? I didn't know, but that's where the mechanistic model is, isn't it?
It seems to me that the mechanistic model is quite useful in certain circumstances, like when you're getting rid of kidney stones. They're a thing, and you want to get rid of them.
Yeah.
You know, now, how you got them in the first place, that might not be best addressed as a mechanistic question. Yeah.
All right. Well,
That that fits with my experience very closely as well. You know, I've been critical of science being very reductionistic. I've felt like that's a weakness of science. But when my son was born 3 years ago with a fatal heart defect, I was very glad that there was a surgeon at Boston Children's Hospital who had spent all those years in medical school learning the mechanistic, very specialized scientific way of thinking about things. I was very glad that he had done all the specialized pediatric training and the very specialized cardiology training that he had done, and that he could do this open heart surgery on a baby who was 3 days old. And you know, thanks to that technology and that specialization, Timothy's robust and alive and well today, 3 years later. That's an example of one of these positive things, I think, where the Pope and Pope John Paul II before him had a good appreciation for the values of science and for the things that science has done which are helpful. But I think we just need to be careful about not letting science become an idol and worshipping it at its altar, thinking that it is the be-all and end-all.
I'm happy for your son's condition was, or the outcome was a positive one. And you're right, the Pope, I guess in the prior one, but particularly in the encyclical, he goes in a middle path. He praises the goods of science, but also criticizes the excesses in the techno-economic paradigm in a more fundamental level. But Pope Francis also introduced the term integral ecology to describe the holistic model of caring for the earth and the populations most adversely affected by climate crisis and our technologies. You spoke of this on the panel discussion, and can you talk about the concept and your interpretation and implementation of its principles, as well as explain the Pope's concept?
When you asked me at the beginning about my work in sustainability and how that led me to be interested in the encyclical, in a sense, that word sustainability is not the one which the encyclical uses repeatedly, but this idea of integral ecology seems really foundational and important to both to Francis's critique of the way things are at the moment and also to pointing the way forward. And that chapter 4 in the encyclical, even though it's a relatively short chapter compared to some of the other ones, I think is one of my favorite chapters because it lays out so clearly this vision of the interconnectedness of knowledge. And so he wouldn't see environmental problems as being separate. You can't separate environmental problems from social problems. You can't separate people from creation. It's one of the problems with this word environment, and one of my mentors has been the farmer and poet and an essayist and short story writer and novelist Wendell Berry. And Wendell Berry is another person who's often made this critique of the word environment as if there's something out there and it's separate from us, that we are the environment. You know, in the Torah, in the opening account of how the world begins, we're made from earth. We're made from the dust, and so we're breathing the stuff in. We're eating the stuff, all the creation, all the time. So we can't really separate ourselves, and that I think is one of the insights at the heart of this idea of integral ecology. But he goes beyond that as well, and he says that it's we need a cultural ecology. We need to understand the importance of cultural heritage. We need to not place indigenous knowledge and indigenous people in a lower position than science, and think that science is somehow better than that and that's primitive. So he's got a very rich idea of, if we want to understand ecology and we want to understand the relationships between ourselves and the world we live in, that we need to bring all kinds of different disciplines to bear on that, or what we would call disciplines in the modern academy.
Let me read from the encyclical on this, just at the beginning, the heading titled Environmental, Economic, and Social Ecology. It says, ecology studies the relationship between living organisms and the environment in which they develop. This necessarily entails reflection and debate about the conditions required for life and survival of society, and the honesty needed to question certain models of development, production, and consumption That's right to the point.
It gets right to it.
Yeah, it cannot be emphasized enough how everything is interconnected. An amazing statement. Time and space are not independent of one another. And not even atoms or subatomic particles can be considered in isolation. Just as the different aspects of the planet, physical, chemical, and biological, are interrelated, so too living species are part of a network which we will never fully explore and understand. A good part of our genetic code is shared by many living beings. It follows that the fragmentation of knowledge and the isolation of bits of information can actually become a form of ignorance unless they are integrated into a broader vision of reality. When we speak of the environment, in quotes, what we really mean is a relationship existing between nature and the society which lives in it. Nature cannot be regarded as something separate. He goes right to scientific principles that I had mentioned earlier, the Fritjof Capra and the quantum theory and other things to... And Einstein, to actually bring forth the point of the interconnectedness of all and how it makes the environment actually a social condition. So can you talk to that?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, this is the stuff that, this is the reason why I love the chapter on integral ecology so much. And when you started reading that opening section, I was really hoping you would get to the end of that paragraph where he talks about how if you have this vision of reality, then it follows that the fragmentation of knowledge and these isolated bits of information can actually become a form of ignorance, that it's got to be integrated into a broader vision of reality. And so this way of thinking about things, for example, when you see a polluted river, an integral ecological approach to that would not just ask why... What chemicals are in the river and how do we remediate those chemicals? What Francis talks about in this chapter is if you want to understand why it's polluted, you've got to understand the workings of society. You've got to understand the economy that's led to that. You've got to understand the behavior patterns. And ultimately, you've got to understand the worldview of the people who are living in this particular way. And so he's all about thinking systematically and in terms of systems and not seeing things in these isolated little discrete parts. And one of the great strengths of science has been the way that it's divided and conquered, but I'm choosing those words carefully. When it divides, it often separates things which need to be connected, and so it can't really gain a full appreciation for those things in their context. And this idea of conquering has sort of been too much at the root of science, I think, since Francis Bacon's time. So Francis is trying to get us to think in different categories to those. He's trying to say to us, if you want to solve these problems, if you want to combat poverty, for example, that there are environmental components to this. And these are themes which people in the environmental justice movement, people like Robert Ballard, for example, have been writing about for several decades, that justice and environmental issues are not two separate issues. This is part of the same system, and these things are interconnected.
I think Rabbi Seidenberg has something to add here.
Mm.
Oh, this aspect of the encyclical is really, I think, the most extraordinary in terms of refocusing how we think about all these issues. It's as much of a strong... rebuke is maybe not quite the right word, but correction to what's going on in the environmental movement as it is a correction to the rest of society. We really need to listen deeply to what he's saying. And of course, as Craig is saying, he's not the first person to say this. A lot of people in the environmental justice movement talked about this. Murray Bookchin did some brilliant work on this in social ecology, talking about how the domination of human beings by human beings and the domination of nature are always intertwined. And, of course, Leviticus 26 just lays it out there, Leviticus 25 and 26. If anyone wants to look at the Torah has to say, that's where you need to look. But if he can really refocus us so that all of us are understanding that when we're talking about nature, we're talking about the more than human world, which includes humanity, and that every problem we create amongst ourselves is a problem that impacts nature and vice versa, that will be a tremendous revolution.
And it's not at all the way that people in a standard biology department would think about this idea of ecology. So that very opening piece that you read for us, that ecology studies the relationship between living organisms and the environment in which they develop, that's pretty straight up kind of classic textbook, high school textbook definition of ecology. But where he immediately takes that is he says this necessarily entails reflection and debate about the conditions required for the life and survival of society. And so there's been a movement like this within biology. People who care about conservation, who care about protecting endangered species, there's this subdiscipline within biology that's called conservation biology, which immediately takes these ecological principles and starts to think about what they mean about the conditions required for the life and flourishing of a particular species. But he's talking about how ecology ought to immediately get us thinking about the conditions required for the flourishing of all creatures, including human creatures. And then he goes further and he says it requires the honesty to question what we currently think about when we talk about development and production and consumption. So in two sentences or three sentences, he's gone from ecology to production and consumption. That's what he means by integral ecology. You can't separate ecology and economy. You know, the roots of these words are the same. They both come from this idea of an oikos, the Greek word oikos for a home or a household. So ecology is the study of organisms or living creatures in their broader household, and economy is also to do with the study of the oikos, the household and parts of its running. But if we divide those two things from each other, then we land up with this truncated view of reality rather than an integral ecology.
We have less than a minute left. Craig, I want you to speak to, well, I did want you to speak to the moral framework of the Pope's thesis, but in the time we have left, maybe give your One Catholic's thoughts on the potential impact of the encyclical.
So the question of the impact of a document like this depends a lot on the degree to which people are willing to think it through, engage with it, chew on it. And so the Pope's goal in writing this, which he says right at the beginning of the document, is he wants to establish a dialogue. You know, he used that word a lot in his in what he did yesterday in Congress. I hope it leads to dialogue, and if it leads to dialogue, it'll have an impact.
All right. Thank you very much, Professor Craig Nicholson and Rabbi David Seidenberg.
All the darkened kitchens, the mill off grey, all touched by the radiance.